Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of The Yield. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Leave a review if you can as well on Apple Podcasts. Help other investors like yourselves find our show and learn more about what we do here at Yield Street. In case you've not met before, my name is Mitch Rosen. I run the real estate platform here at Yield Street. I've been here almost 3 years, and this is probably my 10th to 15th podcast here. Today, I'm joined by Peter Lewis. Peter is the chairman and founder of Warren Equity Partners. Warren Equity Partners was founded in 1987, and since then, he's overseen the expansion of the firm's investment reach across different asset classes and strategies. As chairman of the Real Estate Investment Committee, Peter drives the direction of the firm as it executes its disciplined strategy, recognizing and capitalizing on emerging trends. Specifically on this call, Peter obviously talked about industrial properties. Among other initiatives over the course of his leadership of Warren Equity, Peter has established the firm's multifamily, self-storage, home building, and hospitality platforms, resulting in over $1 billion of transactions. Peter, welcome to the show today.
Thank you. This is so exciting to be here. Before we get started, I want to say one thing. You know, we're going to talk about the metamorphosis of real estate today. But you can't have this discussion without talking about a firm like Yield Street, which is really kind of integral to this change. I started my career on Wall Street in an area called syndications, as you know.
Yep.
Syndications are equivalent to what you guys are doing in this era, utilizing the internet. And it's an example, actually, of how technology is infiltrating the real estate business in so many profound ways. I feel like we're kinship here in talking to each other.
And we've talked about this before, right? Right. I appreciate that. And thank you for that shout out. I mean, we've had this conversation in prior meetings together, right? Where you were doing this in the 80s in a very similar manner, just more of a phone calls and face to face relationship versus a more of a transparent tech focused initiative. Right. So that's great. We appreciate that. Let's get right into this because the metamorphosis of real estate, this is really something that me and you have spoken about before. And you made a very concerted effort at your company, Warren Equities, to make a really specific pitch and directional change in terms of what you want to pursue and how you approach that. Do you want to talk about the last 3 years of what you've been focusing on, how you derived and focus on industrial product and how you've attacked it?
Sure. So the firm has a history of kind of trying to see trends and capitalize on them. We were big buyers of multifamily Southeast value add product from 2012 to 2016, before kind of the new wave of that. But in about 2016 or so, I started getting an itch as I started really understanding what was happening with e-commerce. And I just felt like this was going to be one of the great changes in our lives, surely in my investing career of over 30 years. And so overnight, essentially, we wound up selling over $500 million of our multifamily properties, all of them.
Wow.
And shifted our complete attention in 2017 to industrial. It's almost like there was another force that woke me up and just drove me. Sometimes I figure there's something else inside of me that's moving me. I don't know what it is. But in this instance, we went in pretty aggressively. And over the last 4 years or so, I've done nearly $400 million worth of transactions, and we're growing rapidly. And obviously, the introduction of COVID created a whole nother wave now of demand and fascinating features, which we'll touch on a little bit today. But the force that we're seeing with e-commerce and the kind of the changes that are afoot, as I mentioned before, I've never seen in my career. And I still think we're in the second inning of this change, even though people are saying, oh, money's running into industrial. And no one really fully understands the impact yet of what's happening. And I think we got a big ride ahead.
So let's kind of dissect that a bit, right? you know, 5 or 6 years ago, you saw this trend accelerating. You saw the various players in that space that were growing, looking for additional space, looking for ways to get product to users, consumers like me and you as quickly as possible, most efficient manner, most cost-efficient, time-sensitive manner. So looking at the last, even the last 5 years, can you speak to what changes you've seen? You mentioned COVID specifically, but even before COVID, right? The way industrial is being built, the way it's being utilized for last mile logistics, even cold storage, you mentioned to me at one call we had before, right? So talk about like what you're seeing across the board, not just logistics, but industrial as a whole.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's so fascinating about industrial, if you really think about it, when it was really conceived, let's say around the Industrial Revolution, manufacturing locations, maybe on rivers or ports, it stayed like that for 100 years. There's no reason to really change it. When e-commerce kind of became part of the mainstream, all of a sudden everything changed. So we're looking at an industry that is in complete upheaval based upon the legacy infrastructure that's in place. The concept of a million square foot fulfillment center never existed, let's say 10 years ago. And obviously today it's even, you know, it's very prolific. So I think the great changes that we're seeing, and we were fortunate to be early participants in this, is building, for example, large distribution centers. I mean, to give a sense of a million feet, it's 23 football fields under one roof.
Wow.
And we built a million square foot building in Atlanta, which we leased to Philips Van Heusen. They're using that for distribution into Atlanta, but also as a hub in the Southeast region to distribute their products. This concept didn't exist before. The whole concept of direct to consumers. So 2,500 laborers, let's say, go into a factory or a facility on a day, and they're out there sending out goods to people. This whole concept didn't exist 10 years ago. So with that, let's talk about something else that's really fascinating. So Amazon's obviously, you know, the creature behind a lot of this, and the other guys are playing catch up. I often say the world changed completely when Bezos went from 2 day to 1 day. Once he said, I'm going to deliver goods to most people in most locations for most products within 1 day, the world completely changed. It was June of a few years ago. It wasn't that long ago. So what does that mean? How do you get goods into people's hands in a day? The only way you can do it is by having facilities close to cities, close to the populations.
Yep.
So besides these monster facilities that are being built to send overnight to folks, there's also these properties around major metropolitan areas, which are being retrofitted and changed to service the populations. And so it's almost like taking a deck of cards and throwing it in the air and trying to catch the aces, you know, my view of what's going on, versus, let's say, the other asset classes, which we've played in for 30 years, where they're playing cards. I mean, they're having fun and they're enjoying themselves, but nothing like this.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you highlighted, like, when that was announced, I was really skeptical of how they could actually do that in a cost-efficient manner and still make the margin they need to make to be a viable business. And they've continued to squeeze out those costs out of the shipping, you know, timeline. And it's quite amazing. You know, you almost need to have the Amazon Prime membership for most folks to get the products they need in a day. You know, it spoils them. And so
tremendous technology behind all that, by the way.
Right.
You know, anticipating how good you're going to move. I mean, there's going to be a day where you're going to wind up getting batteries in delivered to your house before you need them because you bought your child a toy 5 months ago and they're saying, you know, it's about time they need new batteries. I mean, the technology is a powerful force here.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things that, you know, we want to touch on today.
So talking about that specific point, the change in the way Amazon was doing single day delivery of product, obviously it's probably an easy question to answer, but tell me like what you saw as an investor in industrial assets. Was it overnight? Was it that curve of demand just accelerate and steepen right away? Was it over time? Was it their voracious appetite for anything that was on spec that was being built that met those parameters? Like, tell me more about how you saw that as an investor.
Well, this is a really good one to address because we actually have a case study on a property that we bought in South Philadelphia a couple of years ago, which was this rundown, disgusting looking warehouse that had 30-foot high ceilings and rails running through the middle of it. So it was a subway repair facility. And most of the local investors who were legacy owners of industrial real estate down in that market, many of whom were friends of mine, so I don't want to disparage them, but they looked at that building as seeing it as an old, rundown property in a not-so-great area. we were naive New Yorkers, and we came down there and saw it as a building that was situated next to 4 million people, a very active port, an airport, et cetera. And the second we walked through that building, we called the brokers that were buying the building. I mean, he was a little floored because other guys had walked through there. But the point of the matter was this. What we saw there was by renovating the building and taking care of the issues that were there, new roofs, new windows, all that, we were fortunate along the journey to have Amazon come and take the building. And during that process of negotiations and then subsequently, we really got a little view into how they see the world. They're using that facility. There's no racks in this facility. It's all lay down space where goods come in and out of there. So it's sprinter vans, and it's conveyor belts. So they're all built on speed. The pace upon which Amazon is consuming real estate around the major cities is unbelievable. It's not even like beyond. It's beyond anything we've ever seen in our career. And they're doing it in a stealthily manner, by the way. And while the other guys are kind of figuring it out, Amazon's grabbing all the real estate. They're almost building moats around these cities. And so when you say it almost looks like it's happening overnight, it's been a number of years, but in the span of industrial real estate, it's a nanosecond in time. Right. And the interesting thing also, when you think about the cities, there's only certain areas where industrial is designated. And these areas are actually shrinking because of gentrification. Philadelphia's industrial market is shrinking because they're turning buildings or air, they're tearing down buildings and making them residential. So we have this weird paradox going on where there is increasing demand for this kind of space and shrinking supply. And that's why I believe rents are going to continue to rise, building values are going to continue to rise. And while you're in the middle of it, it feels like, I should have bought that building because look what it is now. You have to kind of really understand and believe that rents and values are going to continue to run for the reasons I talked about.
Yeah. And we had this conversation, I remember maybe it was a year ago, where you made a comment to me, something to the effect of, it's not inconceivable and this is now 2 years ago, that you're going to see industrial rents at $7 to $10 and maybe even $12 to $15. Why is it at $4? It was a comment you made to me some time ago, and we're seeing that.
It's unbelievable. I mean, rents are passing $10. They just did it 8A, exit 8A on the turnpike. But you're now seeing even in Philly, and maybe we were the culprit because of our deal with Amazon, but $7-$8 is now the norm. I would guess within the year, 18 months, all the Philadelphia area will be above $10. I think the Meadowlands is probably getting close to 20. It will eclipse 20. And also the other force that's driving this is the cost of construction and the cost of land. So the combination of all these factors are going to push rents higher, and then obviously the scarcity of product. And the final point here is, at least the big companies, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out with the smaller guys, but the big companies begrudgingly can support this price. They were spoiled forever. But the rent is not a material piece of their supply chain cost. It's only about 5%. So the value of being close to the population, having loyalty to their customers, delivering in the day, all those factors are going to overtake the rising costs that they have to absorb. Right. And so it's really unbelievable to see the pace of increases going on right now.
So you mentioned a comment that people often utilize, what inning we're in or where we are in the life cycle or, the timeline, I should say, is a better term for that, of this trend, right? And you say second inning. I remember in college, my professor pulled out the 10K of Amazon and asked us which company this was and what it looked like. And if you look at it from now and then till now, it's a whole nother animal.
Hope you bought some stock.
Yeah, I didn't, unfortunately. I wish I had. With that being said, do you have concerns about oversupply, although you did highlight, right, there is limited land that's zoned actually for industrial use. But what concerns or what keeps you up at night about industrial in particular? I mean, there has been comments made that this may sound outlandish, but like even drone delivery, right? Like, or stuff that we can't really put our fingers on now, but you could see really change over time. Is there a reason why Amazon would actually at some point stop, take less space because they're more efficient in the existing footprints they have? Like stuff like that. Have you talked through that with them or heard commentary around that? Or is that not something that really you worry about?
No. I don't worry about Amazon pulling back. They're not going to, but even if they did, what the next wave is going to be are the middle market companies and the smaller companies that are realizing, and COVID highlighted this, by the way, that they need to have an online presence. So we're just seeing now the maturation and growth of these companies coming into the markets. And we witnessed that through our portfolio of properties that we own, because we're not only working with the Amazons, we're working with the 5,000 square foot users, the 10,000 square foot users. So we're in dialogue with these folks. And you could see the way they're rethinking their business. This kind of grassroots movement isn't to happen. We're not even talking about the top of the second. So the things that keep me awake at night are just a normal kind of thing an investor thinks about, which is, I don't want to pay that much for land, or I don't want to pay that much for this building because a year ago it was this.
Right.
Those are the things that get me nervous. But sometimes you have to, it's a hard thing to do because I'm a disciplined investor, but sometimes you have to have a belief in your convictions and not look backwards so quickly. But I do think there's going to come a day in the next few years, we're not there yet, where kind of like what happened in New York City with retail rents, which went through the roof. At some point, the tenants cried uncle and they couldn't afford the rents. I don't know when that happens, but we're not there yet, and it's not going to be for a while. I worry about markets where there's lots of land, where overbuilding, because building these buildings is not complicated.
Right.
And so you've got to, we really continue to look at markets that are very densely populated and have constraints around land. I'm nervous about other parts of the country. And that, if you ask me about, we're not sleeping well about that because I'm not in those markets.
Right. You're not in Houston. You're not in Texas, you know? Where there's no zoning, right? You're not in those markets where it's quite easy to build. Right. Okay. That makes sense. And that's, by the way, you look at, you know, I remember looking at a map at one point where you can, from like four cities, you can target, I think 75% of the U.S. population.
That's right.
Right. So effectively you can target certain markets. I'm sure that those are the ones you are. You mentioned Philly, whole Eastern Seaboard, down to North Carolina, up through Maine, right? So you can get to a huge component of the population in a day. Mm-hmm. You also talked about technology around industrial, and specifically around your view or your comment that at some point you could see these be fully automated facilities with no manual human labor, and be more efficient in their footprint than they are today. Do you see that like happening in properties that you've actually owned and or developed or looking to develop, and what does that look like?
There is no question automation is coming in a really big way. COVID also, again, proved to many owners and companies that are tenants that not being reliant upon human labor is going to be important in the future. Union issues, obviously disease, God forbid, things like that are going to, rising wages, obviously, are pushing towards automation. And also just because machines are more efficient. So we are, I think they said today, 80% of warehouses are not automated at all. This is going to flip over the next number of years as robotics get cheaper and easier to implement. But on the point of seeing facilities right now that are actually automated, we are big believers in micro-fulfillment, which are these 10 to 20, 30,000 square foot buildings next to big cities that are fully automated. And we're working with a company right now in laying out a program with them to build properties across the country and also maybe make an investment in the firm. But the use of robotics and automation in these facilities is, again, we're at the inception of that.
Can you speak to that a bit? Because the term micro-fulfillment center is not one that probably most of our listeners are used to or aware of. It's obviously 10 to 30,000 feet. It's more infill, right? It's closer to the population centers. What is the advantage of that for a company like Amazon or Target doing two-day or one-day shipping that the warehouse, the million square foot warehouse you highlighted, is it a different product that you would warehouse in those because they're smaller, right? It's not TVs. It's,
Right. It's definitely smaller goods. It's goods that they want to get into people's hands in an hour or two because people are getting spoiled. You know, they love one day, but now they're saying, hey, I want it in 3 hours. So, or quicker, right? I mean, it's nuts. So you got to be right on top of them to do that. Now, one of the facilities that I actually walked through about a month ago, which was fully automated, was dealing with a major health and beauty company. I don't want to mention who they are. Okay. And what they're doing is they're delivering from all automated from this location, their goods out to all the hairdressing salons that they service in the tri-state area. So an eyelash thing or lipstick, and they're fulfilling those and shooting these products out to those places instead of having a guy, you know, in a big warehouse somewhere and
picking product off the shelf. Yeah, yeah.
So now what's fascinating about this, and this is important to realize, in that instance, when you think about beauty salons, that's actually physical real estate. So what in this instance, this company is not necessarily doing direct to consumer. They're doing B2B. And so they're actually supplying physical real estate. So one of the things which is important to really realize is that there is a branch of physical real estate that's going to continue to thrive and grow. You know, we won't get into retail today, but to generally say retail is dead is a grave mistake. Pardon the pun. And by the way, it's an area that we're looking at, you know, because we always love when people say, you know, the herd goes in one direction and says, no, no, no. And that's when I like to think about something else.
I realize that the purpose of this call topic was an industrial mainly, but I would like to touch on retail for a second because it's, some would argue, maybe many would argue that the rise of industrial and the omni-channel and or direct channel is really a function of the demise of the direct in-shopping experience, right? And the way in which people shop is different and the friction point of going to a store, picking something out, trying it on, waiting online, going to return, it's a hassle. I don't enjoy it. Most people don't. But I also think about grocery shopping, hairdresser, like you mentioned, a nail salon, restaurants, things that you really are experiential for people that people like to go do, pick out their own groceries, mm-hmm. whatever it may be. 2% of grocery shopping is done online today. Now, some could argue it'd be 25% in the next 5 years. I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but I actually don't think they're Amazonable or, you know, Amazon's going to make them go extinct. However, clothing companies, shoes, more commodity products could see that happening. Do you have a view on the retail implication of the industrial boom that you're highlighting and where you'd want to invest capital?
In retail?
Yes.
Well, I mean, look, obviously service-based retail, shoes, all the things that we talked about that you can't really do online are going to continue to exist and thrive, I think. But the proliferation of malls that occurred in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, you're going to see half those malls go bye-bye. And in many instances, particularly as you get into, let's say, the center of the country, where they're going to be great distribution points. They're usually located on major highways. So they're going to be retrofitted or torn down for distribution, maybe multifamily, some other
yep.
uses as we kind of change. But I love infill retail. I think it's, again, it's a wave's occurred. A lot of these guys are out of business now. So we can't just look at what's happening right now, because if you go to these centers today, you're going to see a lot of foreign signs.
Yep.
We're going to have to hop past what just happened and go into a world that I hope becomes more normal. And so I think these centers are going to continue to thrive. And I think the malls in urban areas or close to major cities are going to continue to do well for the reasons you talked about. People are still going to want to go out and shop. I mean, remember when Netflix started really growing, everyone said, oh, movies are over. Who's going to want to go to a movie theater? Movies prior to the pandemic had reached an all-time high as far as
yeah.
you see.
I agree.
So we are still a social culture, and that's not going to disappear, you know, irrespective.
Right. You mentioned actually making investments in technology businesses focused on the industrial sector to a degree. Do you want to speak about that? You mentioned the one company that's the fully automated one, but do you just view that at Wharton as a tangential business to your industrial thesis? Or was this something that you saw that was like just very specific and unique that intrigued you?
I think the merger and convergence of kind of technology, business, and real estate, particularly in industrial, which is really an unusual place for this. For us as a firm, is a major, major push. We have a glimpse inside of how these companies are doing. Companies like the robotics company, for example, we can
right.
see what their pace of activity is. And what's fascinating, it becomes a symbiotic relationship. If we can help that company grow through their real estate, and we're also an owner or piece owner of that company, we win in two ways.
Yep.
So Related, which is a very well-known developer in New York, owns Equinox, owns SoulCycle, that just recently made an investment in another company that kind of services, I think it was healthcare related, that are tenants in their buildings. I mean, how fascinating is that concept as you think about a holistic approach, right? And what drives that, by the way, for me at least, is the notion that as information becomes more and more available and readily available, transparency is the nemesis actually of an investor, because all the inefficiencies that used to exist have been squeezed out of the system.
Yep.
So what's happening is pricing ultimately moves down to a certain mean, and you'll see this in real estate as well. I mean, it used to be where you could buy a building knowing that you're going to get a tax reduction because the guy next door got one 6 months ago. Well, today that information is already known. So it's priced into the building because the brokers say, hey, look at that. You're going to get a tax reduction because of what happened next door. right? So there goes that arbitrage out the door. So for us as investors, we're continuing to think about how do we make a greater return? How do we utilize our knowledge, our information, to make us better investors? It's not like we're going to go start buying necessarily dental practices, although that's an interesting business. But surely businesses that we understand through our core business and the convergence of that is a place that I really want to push this in the future.
I appreciate that, Peter. Let's talk about technology again in a different format. So you mentioned in our kind of preparing for this webinar about how you see owners investing capital in these assets to, you know, almost guess what the next leg of the industry is. You mentioned electric trucks, self-driving trucks, right? Where, how far off is that? 10 years? Is it 3 years? Is it 8 years? We'll figure it out and we'll see together. But ensuring that those infrastructures, that redundant power sources, or what other things are you thinking about that you're putting into your assets that the average listener right now would not even think of? I mentioned electricity, but like, what else is there that you are thinking about? Is it solar power? Is it, you know, things like that?
Obviously, solar is a humongous opportunity, and its rooftops are completely underutilized as far as that real estate. And so that's an area that we continuously look at. And there's lots of tax benefits and other reasons. You know, but you know what's interesting? While there are these high-tech things that are going on in buildings, the buildings themselves are pretty basic. It's going to be ultimately what's going to be inside the buildings that are going to be driven and how they operate, whether they're, you know, unmanned forklifts. All those are what's going to drive but the building itself is pretty basic. It's the low-tech stuff that we think about, which is driven largely by parking, believe it or not.
Right.
So truck parking, trailer parking, the ability to store your vehicles. One of the big reasons Amazon liked our particular site in Philly is that we had an enormous amount of parking. So when you think about real estate today, it's not the tech stuff so much, although it's important. And you know, if you think about technology, you mentioned it briefly. I think driverless trucks, which are actually out in the road at this point in a small way, will continue to grow over time. I think actually you might see that lead the parade versus automobiles, because automobiles become, you're very attached to your car. I'm not sure how that all is going to play out yet.
Yep.
But trucks. So what you could see in the future, and I do believe this, is you'll see the development of more rural, big box, maybe 1 million, 2 million feet, somewhere further out, where it gets loaded up at night and it gets driven to a smaller distribution center, which arrives at 8 a.m. So and by the way, that area where that 2 million square footer is being built needs taxes desperately, is looking for, there'll be labor in those buildings, even though they're automated, because there's still people out. So
yep.
I could see this shifting occurring, and it's going to happen, I think, fairly quickly.
That's a really, really fascinating point you just highlighted, right? That, because it kind of goes counterintuitive to what you highlighted in terms of actual proximity to the urban populations, right? And being able to touch people in the day or 3 hours. What you're highlighting is that you can actually move those bigger facilities outside of those core areas, and it's kind of ties into your micro industrial property mindset, right? Like, you have smaller properties closer in, but you have a bigger facility, maybe hour or two out. I just think about like the benefits as a person, a resident of New York State. Imagine if all those trucks were on the road between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., right? And you just kind of reduce that traffic from, now the argument be made that you're gonna have all those delivery trucks to the end user at their homes and locations during the day, but it's still less than we have now, because we have both now.
Mm-hmm.
Are there certain markets, you mentioned supply constraint markets on the Northeast Corridor particularly. Have you done stuff on the West Coast at all? Is the same dynamic apply everywhere? Are you seeing certain markets where the adoption of online shopping is different, or the products people offer is different?
Look, the common thread is population and the availability of land. I mean, the Inland Empire is probably the greatest industrial market in the world. Rents and prices of real estate up there are growing like crazy. And it's also proximity to the port, which is the biggest in the U.S.
Right.
But you're seeing this phenomenon in Seattle, and you see it in Savannah. The port cities are flourishing, as you can imagine, right now. So we're not on the West Coast because we have our hands full on the East Coast and down to Florida. We are completely in love with Florida. I mean, there's the influx of people, the quality of life, COVID or no COVID. COVID is pushed that, but it was happening beforehand.
Yeah.
And so those markets are continuing to thrive. And so we really like that market. So we're really focused on kind of the growth markets, let's say in the kind of the Southeast. But there's nothing beats population. I don't care if people keep saying, oh, everyone's leaving New York to go down to Miami. It's a tiny percentage of the overall population, and you can't beat the density if you're a retailer, for sure.
Let's talk quickly about, you know, how you're investing capital going forward, given what you've highlighted in the industrial sector. Are you looking to buy raw land and develop yourself? Are you actually acquiring existing properties that need retrofitting? Are you buying leased up stabilized assets that have a value add component with a lease roll in your market to market? Like, what is the thesis that you are attacking industrial at Warden?
Well, there's a very common thread here. I love anything to do with industrial, as long as it's a kind of piece of the location that we want to be in. So the beauty of the firm is that we don't have any particular mandate that would restrict us from doing land, raw land, all the way through to buying existing buildings at a triple net lease. The common theme, though, is it has to be great real estate. So we are actively across the spectrum looking at buying land and taking it through approvals, looking at building, and then also buying completely wrecked buildings or buildings that need value. We generally, though, as a firm, we want to create value. That's our real play. But the first things first is, where is it located? And then you start layering all the variables of the questions you would ask, like if it's a land deal, how much other properties are online? What's going on in the planning department? How long is it going to take us to get approvals? What are the risks with environmental? Like, the other thing, which is a really fascinating phenomenon as we look at developments, which is also going to play a role in limiting supply in the future, is social media's emergence now of a powerful force, against and for development. So overnight, you can put a Facebook group together saying, stop Wharton's building down right. The street. I mean, literally yep. In an hour. And by the way, another risk that's emerged very quickly here is political risk. There's always been political risk, but it's usually been more slow moving. You know, waiting between administrations, and today it's instantaneous because the elected officials are getting judged in nanoseconds.
Yes,
by their
news cycles, nanoseconds. Yeah,
and you're seeing that in the news. You're obviously witnessing that in real time. So this is a really fascinating new ingredient in the development process. So the combination of emerging concerns around environmental, of strong-willed residents. All these factors lean towards one thing, which is continuing to keep constraints on development. A good example, by the way, of this is the Lehigh Valley, which is one of the biggest industrial markets in the country.
And massive market, yeah.
It's in a great location.
Pennsylvania,
right?
Yep.
A number of years ago, they opened the doors and let everyone in. If you go there today, you'll see million square foot buildings next to 300,000, 400,000 houses. They don't want them anymore. They don't want these boxes because what's happening at 12 o'clock at night, these trucks are pulling out and lights are in their living rooms.
Oh, wow.
So it's amazing to see, but there are actually groups that will go from other towns to help them organize in opposition to development. And this takes its toll on guys. After a while, they just throw their hands up and say, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
So, you know, this is what makes this change so fascinating right now. It's because you have these forces which are going to limit development at a time when you really need it. So what does that mean? What I think is going to happen here is you're going to start seeing some of the secondary markets get more attention. So markets that the whole Eastern Seaboard, in my opinion, over the next few years is going to be one big supply chain.
Yep.
And so you can, I don't want to necessarily give all our little tidbits out today, but if you look exit by exit up the coast, there are certain areas that are, you know, maybe formerly they're cities that are in disrepair. I think over the next number of years, you're going to see very large interest start drifting into these overlooked markets. And we're fascinated by that. We're moving quickly on trying to buy ahead of the curve.
Like Baltimore. Is Baltimore a city you're thinking about?
Baltimore is a great example. They're actually been thriving, but there's still room to run down there. But there's some other ones further north. And I just think if you can be on 95 or close to it, I don't care where you are, you're going to hit population within a certain period of time and there's going to be value.
Yeah.
And so this is the next stage for our company, which is not looking in the obvious locations. Exit 8A, which is really kind of like the main for big boxes on the East Coast, the prices are just moving to a place where only the Brookfields can afford to pay it,
you know,
because their cost of capital is so cheap. But for guys like us, it doesn't work. So
right.
Then you got to start thinking about, okay, how far off of 95 am I willing to go, east and west? you know, and then you start pushing up to the frontier. One of the things I've learned over 30 years, though, is you got to still have discipline about this, because at some point the music stops on development. It just does. It's not because of the e-commerce is slowing. It could be a real spike in interest rates. It could be some other factor that puts a slowdown on it. And when the world slows down, the further you are away from the action, the longer it takes for you to come back and recover. So it's a very interesting dance that we're going through right now as to, you know, can I go 45 minutes off of the turnpike? You know, I'm a little nervous about that, even with this craziness that's going on with e-commerce, because I'm worried about what happens if the world changes. So we're trying to find those things where we're almost insulated from, you know, from the downside of a changing world, and positioning ourselves for continued growth. And that's not easy to do.
This is great, Peter. Your insights were fantastic. I do want to take a devil's advocate for a second, right? Because I think about some close friends or family members of mine who view what Amazon has done as a net negative in society. And they're talking about the destruction of mom and pop businesses in small communities, the continued, I won't say monopoly, it's not monopoly, but like the way in which they can exert so much influence on what is purchased and how eyeballs are seen. When I think of Amazon now, it's really a search engine, right? Most of the products they sell are actually third-party sold products. They now warehouse them and process them for those sellers, right? But most product on Amazon is actually not Amazon sold. It is through third-party vendors. And how they, in some cases, they can influence their success or failure of those vendors, right? And their power. And so I wonder, you mentioned the political risk and people speaking up about it. At some point, you could see a scenario where people say, listen, there's so much power held within these groups of e-commerce sellers. You know, is there a backlash against it? I would argue the capitalist side of me says, look, if someone can deliver a product faster, cheaper, and in a more pleasurable experience, that's just the way life goes, right? So that's the other side of that conversation. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if there's a desire over time for people to reinvigorate that mom and pop shop. You see like Amex, for example, for Christmas time, you know, shop local campaign. It's a very big campaign every year they do it. I don't know if there's some kind of inflection point where there's a backlash against it. I don't see what would cause it, but I just wonder if these are kind of some of the thoughts that these people you mentioned who start these Facebook pages are kind of like enough's enough. And it's just like, you know, it's impersonal. It's kind of, it hurts local businesses. It doesn't employ people as much, right? Industrial product does not bring the kind of vitality and energy to a property like an office property would, or retail or multifamily. It's a different animal. So is there some stretch point where they say, look, we don't want industrial this close to an urban center anymore. You, like to your point, be an hour, 2 hours away. You mentioned Lehigh as one example. I don't want to say think this, but it's something that I've heard spoken about. I'm not even sure how it manifests itself.
All right. I'm not a proponent of what Amazon is doing. I'm not saying it's healthy, but it wasn't healthy when we went from horses to automobiles. How many guys who were, you know, shoed horses were out of business?
Right.
You know, our world continuously changes. The field gets cleared. I think what will happen, you're seeing this, by the way, organic foods are rising, which is hurting. Whole Foods hurt Kroger's. I think there'll be competitors merging that will be more authentic or different than Amazon that will nip at their heels. But unfortunately, the voters of America all shop at Amazon.
Yes.
I will promise you, all the senators who might vote against it, even the Democrats, all shop at Amazon. So, you know, for greed or other reasons, I don't see Amazon getting eviscerated. But I do think that there will be continuously novel ways to compete with Amazon, which are going to get traction, and they pop up all the time. You know, one of the things which I believe, ironically, is that the pandemic will look back at the pandemic as one of the greatest incubators of innovation that we've ever seen in our lifetime. Now, couple that with quantum computing and all the other factors that are going to start kind of coming into play, which
AI,
is creating,
another buzzword,
you know, a great period of innovation. So let me give you an example. I could see a world ahead of us where Bloomingdale's, for example, has a virtual store in what's called the metaverse, right? And you put on your glasses, you get in there, you walk down the aisle in Bloomingdale's, you have someone help you, they have your size already, you're trying on a dress or a suit, You're buying it there. It's Bloomingdale branded, and it gets shipped to you, boom, right? You're bypassing Amazon. You're creating an authentic experience. So I don't know yet how this all plays out, but Amazon's going to exist. You know, I don't see any force that's going to overall stop it, but I could definitely see ways where others are going to encroach upon their, their prowess.
That makes sense. And that's a great way to, I think, to finish up here. I want to say again, Peter, on behalf of Yield Street, myself, Mitch Rosen, Joe, my colleague, thanks for joining us today. Fantastic job. Again, Peter Lewis of Warren Equity Partners. Visit www.yieldstreet.com to learn more about our offerings and come realize your next level with us. If you're an originator in need of capital, please reach out to us at originations@yieldstreet.com. See you all next Wednesday, July 28th, with Noah Kupperman, our head of business development for our art finance business. We'll be speaking with Jacqueline Towers Perkins, auctioneer and VP director of post-war contemporary art at Bonhams. See you all again. Peter, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mitch.
Take care, man.
Enjoyed it.
Be well.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.